the guys from Ping, they've kind of shown me how much the equipment matters.
I just love that I can hit any shot I kind of want.
We're going to be able to tell some fun stories about what goes on here to help golfers play better golf.
Welcome back to the Ping Proving Grounds podcast. I'm Shane Bake, and that is Marty Jurtson. Marty, I say this a lot. We've got a special guest today, a very exciting guest at that.
Yeah, this is a fun one. This is one I think all golfers out there have been touched by his what he's brought to this game in one way or another. Chris Como.
Hey guys, thanks for having me.
Chris, how did you get into instruction? When did that interest hit you? When did you see that as an avenue in your world?
I think kind of like really early on. I took up golf somewhat late, like when I was like 16, and I've always loved sports, and you know, I got pretty good at golf pretty quickly, but I sort of had this idea in my head that if I could like study everything, read all the books or whatever, I could expedite the process of getting better at golf just by like learning as much as possible, because I got completely just like obsessed with the game, you know, once I started playing. That was misguided, right? Like the pathway to getting really good at golf is not like reading every golf book that there is. but that like, you know, really started me down this path of just being like so intrigued by the game and, you know, how do you get better at it? I mean, like, and just the fact that there's like so many different opinions. I mean, I remember reading books on, you know, a guy who's the number one coach in golf and the number two coach in golf and the number three coach in golf. And they had like wildly different opinions. And it's like, whoa, like what gives? So it just really triggered this curiosity about the game and just the overall mystery of like, you know, how can you hit this incredible shot in one moment? And then the next moment you're like, you know, chasing a ball into the woods or it goes out of bounds or whatever. I think there's just a lot of like kind of mysteries to the game in some ways. It's a big puzzle. And early on that grabbed me. And then, you know, the natural segue from sort of the curiosity of the game and how to get better at it is then how do you help other people get better at it? And that's kind of, you know, really early on, I started down that pathway of coaching, essentially.
Chris, I think that's what we love about having you as an ambassador is how curious you are, how you've asked us to, in the research end, to help answer some very deep questions. Do you feel like you have... do you feel like you've had all these questions in your head and a bunch of them are answered and you're getting closer to the end? Or do you feel like as you've answered some of these questions, it's opened more doors to more than ever? Where are you at on that kind of spectrum?
Yeah, I mean, you definitely start to make progress. And I think, you know, you have more and more like phenomena, if you will, kind of like understood a little bit better. And then, you know, as a teacher, you get more tools in your tool set type of thing. But probably like most things, as you start to open it up and ask the questions, you know, more questions arise. And you finally sort of concede that this is going to be a never ending thing. And, you know, you'll be whatever years old and you'll be like, oh, you know, that was a lot of fun. But here's sort of like the next set of questions for the next generation to kind of play with and make their own progress with. So. It's probably like anything else you do with, you know, what you can with the time you have in it. And it is sort of this never ending thing, which is also part of the fun and challenge of it all. So,
yeah, Chris, I mean, the doors in golf open and close as well for players, right? I mean, you evolve and you get better and you work on things and maybe a part of your game deteriorates and you're trying to work on that. I can only imagine in the world of instruction, you're always pushing ahead because you've got to kind of stay ahead of the golfers. I mean, you think about the way we launch drivers versus the way players in the late 90s and early 2000s hit their drivers, right? It's completely different. I mean, you go watch John Daly in 92, 93 pound his driver, and that ball is coming out low and spinning. And now, obviously, the way Rory launches it, it is starting out way up in the air right off the face. How, for lack of a better term, how ahead of the golf curve are you in terms of paying attention to new technology and new thoughts? How hungry do you have to stay to be where you're at right now in the world of instruction?
I think you're trying to help people get better, right? And then like, say, you know, on the PGA Tour or whatever, I mean, it is, the a PGA tournament is in essence a zero sum game. It's like if someone plays better, then another guy is going to make less money, right? So like there is that element of it. So there is trying to find like edges for the guys that you're working with. So there is that sort of zero sum game kind of like competitive mindset that does exist of helping a guy find an edge. And those edges, again, it's probably this never ending thing, and the edges get smaller that you're trying to push, and as equipment changes, the whole set of variables that you're trying to find edges with change. If all of a sudden they do a ball rollback or whatever it is, it's essentially changed the rules of the game. So now all of a sudden you got to have to find edges within that new rule set, so to speak. Right. But then there's also like the macro of it where you're just trying to like help the game grow. You're trying to grow the GDP of golf and golf instruction and how people enjoy the game. And that's not zero sum, right? That's where you can help other people be better too. And that part's fun as well. So for me, it's always kind of that dance between those two worlds of trying to find the edge in a very competitive sense. And there's also trying to make, impact or progress that can help like everybody in the golf industry. So I think you're trying to do both at the same time at some capacity, but I don't know. Again, it doesn't ever end, right? It's just the variables are changing, the rules are changing. So you're always finding, I don't know if it's ahead of the curve. It's the landscape's changing enough that if you are going to find edges, you gotta sort of keep looking. And for me, the hunger part, like curiosity has always been like a pretty strong driving force for me. So, as long as there's questions that's like, I don't know the answer to, or there's things where it's like, oh, that's interesting, I haven't seen that before. I think that sort of natural hunger that comes from that curiosity will probably always be there.
Chris, you touched on some of it. I have my own hypothesis on why you've taken this approach, but I've always wanted to ask you this question. You talked about in terms of helping the golf community, other golf instructors get better. That's kind of why I led off with you've touched a lot of players, whether they know it or not. But you've taken this approach to be very open with sharing your questions, your ideas, crowdsourcing, getting answers to those questions to the other best golf instructors in the world, where I would think that, other great teachers might keep some things like trade secret or close to their chest on their findings or what they're trying to research. Why have you taken that approach? What's been the inspiration story behind this approach to be a little bit more open with asking these questions and these deep scientific or biomechanical questions that you've done over the last decade or so?
That's an interesting question. Huh. I'm not sure if I fully know the answer to that. I would say, I don't know. I think I genuinely like just sharing and seeing the industry grow. I mean, I didn't grow up playing golf and no one in my family played golf. Golf's expensive and I didn't grow, I didn't grow up in like a very sort of like affluent environment or anything. And golf has like provided so many incredible things for me. So there is an element of like just an appreciation for the game. So if I can like impact and give to it, that's awesome. Like, I love that. I have an appreciation for teachers, like the teaching industry. I know it's a tough gig, right? Like I've done it in so many different versions, teaching at a driving range where you can barely pay your bills or whatever. So I just have a strong sort of like appreciation, affinity for people in the business. So there is just a genuine sort of like, I like kind of like sharing it. I like the dialogue. I feel like having it be more open sourced allows more people to think about it. So I think there's, a higher acceleration at my own learning. Cause it's like, yeah, you can ask like a good question or give an insight to something, but the bigger the population of people who are like maybe talking about something, they're going to have their own ideas, which is going to have its own sort of like, loop to it to where I'm going to get better with it. So there's that. Like you have these different aspects of you as like a human, right? I'm very curious. There's like a part of me that likes to like share with the community, but then there's also a part of me that's competitive and wants like my guys to play really well. So how do you like, how do you have all those things be true at the same time and like get the most out of it? I think I'd at least like to think, maybe this is a little cocky, but I'd like to think that part of my edge in the competitive sense is the way I kind of put it all together and the problem solving aspect of it. So I don't look at this as like, here's some rote knowledge and now you know it. And now all of a sudden it's like easy. Like you still got to like figure out how to put the puzzle together. How do you take an individual in front of you who's got their own craziness of their golf swing, the way their mind works, the way their emotions process things. And then you got to like put in maybe some sort of understanding of whatever it is, golf swing technique, ground reaction, whatever the thing is, you know, you're factoring in, and then take this puzzle, put it together, and help a guy play better with it. That's its own thing. That one, even if I wanted to like try to like teach that to someone else, like it's kind of impossible to do. So, you know, I feel like my real edge is the problem solving aspect of it and putting it all together. So in some ways I'm not really worried about, you know, giving that away, I guess. Now someone else might be have their own way that's fits another person better or whatever it is. And, you know, so they could be better with, you know, whatever set of people, but the way I put it together is in a sense, my monopoly of that, good or bad, like it or not like it, it's sort of mine. So I'm not really worried about, you know, competition in that way, I guess.
Chris, what was your, I made it moment? I mean, you know, we all have had it in this world. You're talking about teaching lessons at a driving range and, you know, barely getting by. When did you have the moment where you went, oh my goodness, X paid attention to me, or somebody called me, or, you know, somebody wants my opinion on this? Did you have one of those that comes to mind?
So when I graduated undergrad, like I was at this, like, I wouldn't have been in the golf business unless it was teaching. Like that's the only thing I had interest in doing in the golf business. I would have done something else. And I felt like, in part because like how I had said earlier, there was so many different opinions on what should happen in the golf swing. It's like, if I were to talk to two, you know, physicists and be like, if I let go of my phone, what's going to happen? They're all going to say, well, it's going to go to the ground because, you know, Newtonian physics is sort of understood, right? So to me, that there are such different opinions, I'm like, there's a gap in the body knowledge at some level. And you know, I felt like that was an opportunity. I'm like, I'm going to go out there and really try to be like good at this. I'm going to try to be the best at this. And that's what kind of like set me off on the whole golf coaching path. And, you know, I went and traveled the country. I worked for Led for a little bit, worked for Haney for a little bit, spent a couple years, with Mac O'Grady, kind of hanging out with him, did all the certifications like TPI, Paul Check, yada, yada, yada. And I ended up in Dallas to do an academy. And the first year at this academy, I was working like 60, 70 hours a week, and I made $19,000 at this academy. I mean, they made no money. Like, you know, I was eating into savings, whatever. Right. And it was such a, what's the right way to say this? It was not pleasant. I don't know if you guys can sense this, but it was a kick in a, you know, it was just a kick in the butt where you're just like,
yeah, just a, it's a total grind. I mean, just grinding, grinding, grinding.
And it was one of those things. I had some friends who'd gone to law school, yeah, and I'm making no money. And I'm like, man, this was a bad decision. But it wasn't, because my heart was still like so into it, right? So I end up, long story short, Marty probably knows this, I had joined a free poker league, had done one that free poker league, which I won player of the year in it. They fly to Vegas to play in a tournament, came in fourth in this tournament at the Bellagio, win 40 grand. In one night, which doubled my year salary, take that money, break away at a driving range, and basically start to build like a golf book. But I was also playing poker at night in like the Dallas underground poker scene for a few years. So I'm like funding my golf passion instruction through playing poker at night, which is so ridiculous in hindsight. Start to really, through a couple of like, you know, the right people playing well. There was a guy named Mike Madonna who used to play for the Dallas Stars. He'd start playing some good golf that helped generate some like business. Scott Foss, the guy of Decade, actually met him in a poker room. He got a partial status on the web.com tour. I was helping him, had some really good juniors. And then all of a sudden I start building a book, and I wake up one day and I'm like actually like making a living teaching golf. But it was my own book too. It was like autonomous, right? It wasn't at an academy. It was like my business. It wasn't where I could get fired the next day. It was like, if I had left that driving range, the people would go to me someplace else. So it was like a true sort of like autonomous. I built like a business teaching golf where I can pay my bills. And this was before I went to grad school for biomechanics. This was before I started teaching like tour guys. But it was like a place where it's like, I actually can like do this and make a living doing it, like a decent living. I was actually starting to get really busy and was able to make kind of like a nice living. And that's when I felt like, okay, I made it, because, you know, I was actually able to eat from teaching golf. So
Shane, we're noticing a little bit of a connection here to Victor playing poker too and talking about, you know, trying to get those little edges and making those little bets, right? I think that's pretty interesting. Chris, what about, let's talk about what happened next there. And like, I think, you know, you've brought a lot of the academic, I think, been sort of like the best applied scientist or applied problem solver, taking some very academic principles. And then, as you stated yourself, you know, you think your expertise is how you glue it together and apply it holistically to your players. So tell us about that journey, some of the things you've done. I mean, you've written a couple papers in the Journal of Sports Biomechanics. How did you get into that? And how important has that been for you in your skill set as a foundation, as an instructor?
So I'd, you know, done all that where I'd worked for different guys, was teaching, had built like a nice teaching business. And at this point, I'm now at a country club called Glen Eagles, and I'm like grinding on the range, teaching all day. In some ways, I think I was always like running away from, you know, like that it wouldn't work. So, you know, if someone wanted a lesson, if it was at 6 in the morning or 8 at night, like they're getting a lesson, and I was out there all day, like just grinding, right? And which is awesome. It was such a fun window. A friend of mine, his name's Chris Robinson. I've lost touch with him. I don't know where he is. If Chris Robinson hears this, hit me up. Curious about what you're doing. So he was doing his PhD at TWU, and he's like, there's this really cool biomechanics lab you got to come check out. So I go to this lab, and, you know, they had the Vic. I didn't even, there was just the fancy cameras that you see like in like, you know, video mm-hmm. games or whatever. They're Vicom 3D motion cameras. They had this crazy lab, and there was this professor there named Dr. Kwan. So I go to Dr. Kwan, and I'm like, and they weren't doing any golf research at the point. I'm like, do you have any interest in studying golf? He's like, yeah, bring me golfers. So I start bringing my students, different people from the club. We start collecting a bunch of data, and just me being curious, I start asking them all these questions. And he's like, why don't you just take my undergraduate biomechanics class? So I take the class, and I like loved it. And there was like so many little like things where I was like, oh, that makes sense why I see this in a swing or that, mm-hmm. or starting to understand better the constraints of the human body. And I felt like I had this like flooding of like insights of things that I had seen in teaching or other teachers, things that I had learned. And it just kind of like gave it a framework and sort of the context for those things to make more sense to me. I'm like, this is really cool. So I take the class. Did well in the class, and Kwan's like, hey, you got an aptitude for this. You should do like the graduate program. So anyway, do some other stuff to kind of like prerequisites and yada, yada, yada. I end up in his graduate program and to do a master's degree in biomechanics. And I remember the first semester, the first class was like just like a mechanics class. And it was all like form. And Kwan's this amazing professor, but he's very much like a math first type of professor. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, oh my God, what did I get myself into? I remember going to him and I was like, it was like a month in the class. I'm like, I'm a golf pro. Like, I don't know what I'm doing. And he's like, and he gave me this like pep talk sort of, he was like, there's this proverb where like a Korean general, if the army is like facing what feels like an insurmountable foe, that the general will back the army up against a body of water so they have no place to run. I'm like, you're basically calling me a wuss, aren't you? He's like, yes. So I stuck it out. That first class was actually the hardest. And then we went to it like on a nice flow. I was taking the coursework. I was working during the day. We were collecting data on golfers. Like you mentioned, we published a couple of papers that were really cool. You know, I eventually completed all the coursework for a master's degree in biomechanics. So I've done everything except for I have like a 10-page thesis or something to write. But that's when Tiger Woods called me. Was like right when I was finishing it. So
I'm going to take this call.
Yeah. You know, it's one of those things where, yeah, just starting to get on the technology, looking at 3D data, looking at force plate data, and then having what I felt like because I had all those years of teaching, which was a decade at this point of yeah. teaching at least, and then going to grad school and then kind of like connecting the dots. I don't know. It was just a very, really cool like window of time where I felt like I was getting all these like aha moments because of that context. I don't think I would have had that if it was just like sort of the degree first type of thing. So it was really like, you know, fortunate in that way. And, you know, it, I don't want to say, I actually think in terms of teaching, the best window for me of developed, like my say a set of teaching skill would be when I was teaching on the range and you like, you know, you only again, pay your bills if you help people get better. So it forces you into a very sort of like pragmatic approach to teaching. No, like you got to be here or this position or whatever that you could get away with if you maybe had like a marketing machine or a brand, because people are going to come to you per that. Like I was kind of this unknown person at a driving range that they're not going to come to you unless their friend said, "Hey, I hit it a lot better," type of thing. Right. That was the place where I really, I feel like cut my teeth, just like in terms of actual teaching. But then post that, the research side of it, it becomes this like small edge that I think amplified that previous experience. You know, like anything else, I think over time, as you get maybe better, more proficient at something, it becomes harder and harder to find those like edges. But the more academic side of it blended with the previous experience for me was just like, again, just tons of aha moments. And I think it just helped me kind of take it to, you know, a bit of a higher level. So,
Chris, you mentioned working a bit with Mac O'Grady. I feel like there's two names in golf that when people hear it, their kind of ears perk up in terms of interest. It's Mac O'Grady and Anthony Kim, especially modern day Anthony Kim. Like, where is he? What's he doing? How is it with Mac O'Grady? Because again, I mean, I'm not sure you can just, I'm not going to let you just pass over the fact that you worked a little bit with Mac over the years. So how was it like picking his brain, listening to him? How'd you find him? I mean, how did that whole thing go down?
So I found him. He was playing a US Open qualifier at El Cab, and I watched him play.
Was he playing lefty or righty?
He's playing righty.
Okay.
I watched him play, and then I like cornered him in the parking lot and started to ask him, like, you know, just struck up conversation. We sat out there for, I don't know, at least 2 hours. It went from like, you know, whatever, hey, I'm a big fan, like really love, like, you know, the golf swing stuff, whatever, to this long conversation. He recommended, I was like, what are some books you recommend? He recommended me 5 books. None of them were golf books. they were all just like philosophy of science and like anatomy. Yeah. It was great. He gave me his number. I called him for years. He never responded. And then I found this email somewhere online, sent an email, responded to that. And then I started doing the schools with him. It was great. I mean, it was great. Like, you know, I think I was smart enough for the first year. I didn't ask too many questions. I just listened. And then after the first year, you know, I like asking tough, challenging questions. And, you know, anyway, different people respond to tough questions differently, right? And that's where I feel like, for me, at least, you know, guys like Kwan or Sasha McKenzie, or, you know, Mike Duffy, or, you know, like a guy like Mark Brody and Chris Brody, who's over at Ping, there becomes this discourse where it's like the harder the question, the better. Like I personally, I want people to challenge me. Like I want to be asked the tough questions because I get better from that. So that's in general the environments I like to put myself in, because those are the ones where I think, you know, it really can kind of like sharpen thought and help people advance. But anyway, how is his swing? His swing's so good. Like, you know, I mean, it's beautiful, right? I don't know enough about like his PGA Tour career and how much, like how good of an actual ball striker he is. And this is not sort of to saying to Mac, but in general, I think sometimes like when people hit shots where they take a big divot, the ball kind of comes out and it sounds really good. People get sort of like enamored and it kind of gets romanticized a little bit. But like Jack Nicklaus, like he picked it and like people don't really rave about him as a ball striker, but from a practical sense, that's like probably the best ball striker of all time. Right. So I think people got to be a little bit careful not to romanticize things because of the look at it, of it, but it's like, you know, how does it actually practically hold up in the conditions that you're trying to play in? You know, if you're trying to win majors, hitting it really high to hold on fast greens can be pretty helpful. So again, I'm super appreciative of the time like spent with him. You know, so it was great. It was a great window.
Chris, kind of springboarding on that a little bit and maybe making it, putting all this, that we've talked about in context for the listener, you know, the biomechanics stuff might sound a little out there for some folks, or maybe you know, not tangible, how it can help their game. I think one of the big things you, and I still remember that video you and Sasho did and put out on YouTube maybe 6, 8, 10 years ago, somewhere in that neighborhood, where you guys were talking about the 3D flat spot, right? And you were the first one, I think, to kind of come to us, Sasho, others, yourself personally, and try to figure out what is this concept all about. Explore this concept. For the listener out there that may have never heard of this concept, can you just kind of tell the story of that? Like, you know, how did you get interested in this? And how does it impact your teaching today? What is it? What can players do to maybe try to get a little more flat-ish spot? Maybe not flat, as we know, but and just kind of tell us that story a little bit.
Okay, this can be a bit of a rabbit hole, oh, so yeah. You guys can cut me off. But so, you know, this is like, has to be 13 plus years ago now. Yeah. There's like an air quotes rate of closure debate on one of the forums. And, you know, there was some people in the academic world that was saying like rate of closure has nothing to do with like, it has no correlation with like handicap, whatever. And I think this is where it was a little bit helpful to have some of like the biomechanics background and some of the courses. And I was like, well, I think here's the problem is that the golf coach has an intuition and they're asking a question, but they were using the language. They were using a sort of a different language than like say the PhDs, or they're using words differently than how like a PhD would interpret mm-hmm. those same words. And there became fundamentally like a miscommunication between the two worlds. And so rate of closure at that point was being measured as, you know, angular velocity per second, like at impact. So like sort of like an instantaneous angular velocity. But the golf coaches, they're looking at a camera and they're slowing it down and they're seeing the face look a certain way coming into the ball. And they're saying that looks like that has a lower rate of closure. And when they say rate of closure, that's essentially what they were getting at. But by the PhD sort of language, that's not what rate of closure would be. So in my mind, I came up, I'm like, well, what the golf pro is really asking is what is the change in the face rotationally per how it changes in space, like how its movement is in space. So I came up with this measurement of closure per displacement. So instead of closure per time, closure per how much it's moving linear in space. And then it came to me, it was like, well, if you were to do that with the face, would you do that with the loft? Mm. Would you do that with the club path? Would you do that with the angle of attack? So now all of a sudden it became, could you take these variables that we know make the ball do what it yeah. does and say, what is the change in the path per displacement? What is the change in the angle of attack per displacement? What is the change of the face per displacement and the change of the loft per displacement? And again, people sometimes mistake flat spot as being flat to the ground. It's not that. It's just saying, what is the change of it? If you had less of a change in the path, you would have more of a straighter direction of it in some direction. So it would be less of an arc in a sense. So that straightness could be, you know, 5 degrees down, it could be 5 degrees up, it could be 5 degrees to the right of the target, it could be 5 degrees to the left of the target. It has nothing to do with being flat to the ground. It's just saying, is there less change in that path and that angle of attack? And again, in the face and the loft during an interval, because the whole idea is, you know, is there a window of space where impact could happen? And is there less change of those club 3D club head variables during that spatial interval? And if there is, does that have somewhat of a relationship to the overall shot distribution a person hits? So the idea would be, you know, this is one of the great sort of mysteries in golf to me. It's like, and I think to everybody, and I kind of had alluded to before, like there's plenty of 5 handicaps, 10 handicaps. You know, somewhere in the world, there's an 18 handicap that today will probably hit a hole in one, right? Yeah. So a lot of golfers hit really great shots, like maybe like the best shot possible on that hole would be a hole in one, right? Yep. So if they could do that over and over again, they'd be the best golfer ever, right? Always hit holes in ones. But for some reason, like we also hit these like weird shots, right? Like at least I do. And if you're not like a tour guy, you hit weird shots, right? Where does that come from? And I think a lot of like the instructional like philosophies or frameworks have been an argument to how does the golfer be more consistent? You know, keep your head still, make your left arm across your chest. How do you be more consistent? And that seems to make sense. If I want the ball to be consistent, why don't I be consistent? But then you get like, you know, I remember watching Trevino hit balls and he's like moving around and talking. And I mean, he's freaking not consistent and the ball is just poof, every time, poof, poof, you know? And then you get, you know, I'm sure we've all seen it. Someone who's got like the alignment sticks out and everything's perfect and like all the checklist. And then the ball is going everywhere, right? It's like they're really consistent. And if you were to look at their swing, like imagine your friend, you know, whoever it is, 50 yards away, you watch him, so you know it's him. Like people's swings are actually kind of consistent, right? So it's like what makes certain swings have ball flight distributions be consistent more so than other ones? And I don't think the answer is just in like, you got to be more consistent. And again, like these things have come through, like keep your head still, put your left arm here or there, whatever it is. And it's like, well, it's a hypothesis. Let's test it. You know, Rocco Media moves off the ball a bunch, flushed it. Tiger Woods, Curtis Strange, they had like movement and these guys were all very straight hitters. So the argument of this 3D flat spot stuff is there certain things that are contained in you know, whatever techniques that essentially make the ball flight less sensitive to human error? Mm. And human error could be, you know, you slide on a little bit more or whatever it is, or it could be environmental stuff too, right? Or I should just say error, not human error, but just error, which could also be environmental. Could be like a downhill lie, a side hill lie. It's in a divot, whatever it is, all these different sort of like inherent variables that are existent around a golf. Are there certain techniques that fundamentally make it easier to have the contact you want and the shot flight, the ball flight distribution you want because of that technique? So that's sort of like the question. And then those were the variables that we were starting to look at. And this is where like technology, like Focal, as well as, you know, you guys being kind enough to start to like write in the code to like really look at this better is giving us the opportunity to start to like, you know, potentially answer this question. You know, is there correlations between guys who drive it really well or very good iron players and this variable that is its own continuum, right? Like two tour guys could have slightly different changes in path or angle attack or face, whatever it is. It's not like a binary thing. So it's got its own continuum to it. And does that have some relationship to, you know, their ball striking ability? And then there's obviously going to be other variables that are going to play a role, like, you know, a person's emotional state and mindset and, you know, who knows. But to me, that air quotes consistency question or that repeatability question, I think is, you know, the biggest question in golf that determines like differences in skill set. Because again, there's plenty of whatever 10 handicappers with enough club head speed that can hit a drive that looks like a tour player. But then, you know, a couple drives later, their ball's like hitting a house. So, you know, that to me is one of the phenomena and the mysteries of the game that's fun to try to figure out.
Chris, you did an awesome job connecting. You know, I think the listener out there might be like, hey, biomechanics, you know, what's that going to do for me? I think that you kind of hit on like, that's kind of the holy grail you're trying to find, right? Of that like consistency aspect, which will help the everyday golfer. And you've seen it. The Trevino story is a perfect one, right? You know, I think the golf pros all observe that in one way or the other. It's like, how do you get to the actual, you know, mechanics of how you can teach that and influence it in a practical sense, right?
Yeah. Yeah. At the end of the day, it's like, you know, I think people miss it for at least me. I'm like, I'm so pragmatic with things. And I was a teacher first before I went down this path. But all these are to me are tools to answer very practical questions. Like at the end of the day, that's my end game is how do you just like figure out how to get better at the game? So I do think people can kind of like, oh, biomechanics. It's like, yeah, in and of itself, whatever. But these are tools to answer what I think are really meaningful questions that, you know, again, this is part of the things that grabbed me about this game is that there is like phenomena. There's really interesting things that happen that aren't fully understood.
Yeah.
Again, it's not like, how do you have guys? I mean, there's like whatever, like say a Michael Jordan or some world-class athlete that clearly has got, you know, out of this world hand-eye coordination, a great athlete, and their good shots are unbelievable. But they do not have that sort of repeatability as a tour player does. It's probably not a function of their coordination because they're great athletes, right? So it's like, what are some of the other reasons to explain what is sort of a phenomenon of golf is like, why can you hit a great shot and then, you know, a minute later just hit a shot that's like, you know, not that great.
Chris, the Trevino story was so interesting to me because I remember talking to Brad Faxon about putting, and he would say that a big part of his great putting was he was A, try to leave shots in certain areas where he would have the easiest putt. And then there were times, you know, you think about a great player, a great putter, someone, I mean, you mentioned, you know, like a Justin Rose, right? Who's on the range and he's got all these systems going and he's got alignment rods and he's got the ball and all those types of things to make sure the swing is perfectly online. And then you got somebody like Lee Trevino who's out there making all sorts of different golf swings and he's considered one of the great ball strikers of our generation. I was listening to Steph Curry on a podcast a couple of weeks ago and they said, Steph, what are you focused on when you're shooting? And he said, my entire focus now is just balance. If I'm balanced when I'm set to shoot, I feel like I'm going to make the shot. And, you know, when you watch Steph play basketball, there's a lot of shots where he's fading away or he's stepping back or he's shooting a one-legged kind of floater in the lane and they all go in, right? So for him, the focus is on balance. In your opinion, what is that constant from a Faxon putting to a Trevino ball striking to Tiger to Steph Curry shooting that they all do well, even though they're all kind of juggling the ball?
This is why I think golf is sort of unique. So I think like all the stuff of like having the target and balance and all that, like that maybe like a Steph with shooting is important. And that's probably important through all sports. And, you know, like I think putting may be a little bit different. But I think when it comes to like ball striking, all that stuff matters. But I do think there's another variable. And this is like, say, some of the flat spot stuff that I do think is going to have my prediction is going to be, this is going to have a big sort of prediction on what makes someone hit it better than another one. Because the reality of it is like, you know, let's say even like Justin Rose, right? He's got all, like you said, you're with the alignment sticks. If you're to take away all his alignment sticks and I were to give him like 7 shots of tequila, he's still going to hit it better than I am, right? So like with all my alignment sticks, because I think he does what I would call, like, air quotes, the really good stuff. And like he's kind of always done that for the most part. So he's going to be a really, really good ball striker. Even if you disrupt some of the things that he would makes him feel more consistent, he's still going to have an inherent consistency to his motion that I think is going to kind of trump these other versions of like making it less consistent. So it's kind of an abstract thing. So this is why it's always tough to talk about, but like, I appreciate you bringing it up because it helps me sort of like maybe communicate it better, whatever. And this is a weird analogy and you can hammer this, Marty. But so to me, I think of it as like this, like let's say I had a die, right? And I was, you know, like a craps die or whatever. And let's say I can't really actually read what the die says, but I can read it once it lands and it stops. And let's say I have a die and 5 sides say bad shot on it and 1 side says good shot. Okay. And I roll the die and good shot comes up. It's like, okay, what did I do there? I had my elbow here. Okay. Let me see. My head was here. Bad shot. Oh, what happened? What did I do on that one that I had good shot? Okay. Hold on. I had my here. I had my shoulder here. Bad shot. It's like, oh, what's going on? Like, I thought I had it, right? So that to me would be like a high handicapper. And then on the other extreme would be like a tour guy, which would be 5 sides would say good shot and 1 side would say bad shot. And they're like, good shot. Around the back, good shot. You know, woof, good shot. It's just like sort of easier. Now, maybe they could go through their process and put their elbow there. Maybe in a very small way, they can maybe roll the good shot just a little bit more often. But really, the majority of the probability of the shots that they're hitting is contained in their die. And the die is, you know, for the analogy, is their sort of that late interval stuff that we're talking about before. So that's at least part of this big golf kind of like puzzle mystery. That's part of kind of how I see it as a, again, sort of an analogy to try to help with like something that's sort of like out there a bit. But I don't know. How's that? Does that make sense? Or?
Yeah, no, I think it's looking at it probabilistically and statistically. I mean, that's what the game is, especially you talked about in the tour level, Chris, where you framed it really well at the beginning, you know, we're at zero sum. You're trying to find the micro edge, you know?
But this is where I think from a teaching perspective, if like I've helped make, if you may help a player make, there's certain changes you make where all of a sudden the game, not even a tour guy, but like a high handicapper, they make a change and the game feels easier to them. Just like, yeah, the strike is better, the whole shot distribution changes. So it's like, I don't think this is just I think this is in some ways where players, if they're actually interested in like making improvements in their game, can make massive improvements. So I actually think it's not just a small edge place, but like when someone, if they're willing to make a change, can really experience the game in a completely different fashion.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I totally agree. Chris, one question I wanted to ask you is on the equipment side. Tell us a little insight into either, you know, using a change in equipment, let's say, you know, driver or another club in the bag to help influence a change that a player is making, right? Or have you, what examples have you seen of players playing equipment? Maybe a driver loft is too low and they're doing some things mechanically that's going to fight what you want them to do. Basically, what I want to get to is just kind of talk a little bit about equipment slash fitting equipment slash coaching and how those two things marry together.
Yeah, I mean, you can't separate them. I mean, just, you know, the easiest sort of example is especially if someone's got like some back issues, if the loft is too low, they're going to figure out a way to hit it high enough, especially a better player. They're going to hit shots that fit their eye. So I think you're always, whether it be like the trajectory it's launching at, or if it's like, say, you know, got more of a draw bias or a fade bias, that's all a massive role in terms of the changes you're trying to make with the guy. Cause they're going to make the ball do what they want to do. So, you know, as a, for instance, if someone's got, say, some back stuff and they're kind of like hanging back on it, you know, I'm always going to try to get them, not always, but oftentimes you're going to try and get them into a more lofted driver. So where they have that same move, they hit it too high, and then it sort of like encourages them to, you know, have their chest not be so kind of backed out of it and get sort of stressed in the lower back. You know, and there's so many different, for instances of these, right? So it's like, if I'm trying to get change a release pattern or something, you know, this could work either way, but like either in the spectrum, but like, you know, maybe it's something where I want a club that's more right biased because I need them to do something to like try to air quotes square it up earlier. And for them it's to take out the right or vice versa. Right. So, but at the end of the day, it's, you know, making changes in the golf swing is sort of like, it's part of an ecosystem, and you got to understand how these pieces play a role and then how the player's always going to end up reacting to making the ball do something. And you kind of have to get ahead of that. And that's part of how you put the puzzle together for sure.
Yeah.
Chris, do you still play poker?
No, not really. I stopped. It's funny. I 2007, I played in the World Series. I played in the main event.
Nice. How'd you do it?
I bust out on day one. I qualified for $30, and I actually made it very late in the day one and had almost tripled my chip stack, and I got it. And there was one other guy at the table who I didn't know who he was, and he was just giving me so many fits. And I played a hand with him, and he just completely outplayed me. He was the only guy at the table who had me covered. So like an hour before the day one broke, he busted me. And I'm kind of like, I'm pretty good about like, if I feel like I'm making a good decision and things don't work out, I'm good with like, I'm pretty stoic about like, I made the right decision, whatever.
Mm-hmm. I lost. Right. It's fine.
Life variance. Right. But, I had clearly gotten outplayed and made like a bad decision. So I was like, in the lobby, it was at the Rio, and I was like, my head, I was like, oh my God, I was just so mad at myself. And he comes and sits down next to me, because I feel like I had actually played pretty good at that point. He comes down and sits next to me because it was like right before the day one broke, and then it broke. And I'm sitting on like the bench, and he sits next to me. He's like, you played pretty good. And he introduced himself to me, and he was like one of the best online players at the time in the world. And if I had known it was him, I would have like, just sat on my hands, waited for day two.
Gotcha.
And waited for a table break, because it was actually a really, really bad spot because of just how good he was. And I got toyed with, basically. So
it's like showing up to a money game and it's Victor Hovland and you don't know who he is.
Yeah, like, exactly.
I shouldn't play this guy for 500 a hole. That's crazy.
Yeah, it was I was clearly out of my league. And then after that is right when the golf was like really starting to get busy. And I just stopped playing. It was too hard to do both. Poker was like a blessing. I didn't want to become a losing player, and I had worked pretty hard at it. So I felt like, you know, if I wasn't putting the time into it, I wouldn't be like, I wouldn't be any good at it. So I stopped playing. Once in a while, I'll play, you know, like whatever in Vegas or like different spots, and I'm the donkey in the room. So,
Chris, great stuff, man. It's been fun having you on the team. And, you know, I think it's, you know, we have this, kind of symbiotic relationship with you on the research side, which is like, you know, we need you to keep asking us questions to push us further. Right. And I'm, you know, let's, it's been a fun journey for us, all the team, you know, Dr. Eric, Dr. Paul, the rest of the team, how much, kind of fun questions we've had trying to answer questions through our focal system. It's been super fun. So, let's keep this journey going. And, we really appreciate having you on the pod.
Yeah. I mean, I tell you what, like the relationship with Ping has been so meaningful to me. So I appreciate you saying all that. For me personally, like I just get so much value out of the relationship with you and Paul and Eric and Chris and just the way you guys like go about it. It's so funny because, you know, I've been doing stuff with Ping for quite a while now. And whenever there's like, you know, my sort of like relationship with you guys is contractually up, the start of the negotiation is always like, all right, we both know that I'm never going to go anywhere else. But like, so it's one of those things where
leverage like, is gone, Chris.
I know. It's like,
you've got
like,
no leverage.
I know. Like there's no point of like, you know, not accepting what it is. There's just so much value I get from you guys. And people ask me, cause I'm always trying to be like pretty like transparent with stuff. And it's like, well, you know, what about all the, it's like, there's probably lots of like, I think all the big cloud companies are really good, right? Like they're making good stuff, but I feel so confident in saying that, like from an R&D perspective, the team that Ping has in terms of just that genuine kind of like curiosity of really trying to figure stuff out. Now, maybe someone might like one club, the way it looks or whatever, who knows, right? Like it's just being a human, the subjective aspect of it all. But in terms of the R&D part of it, it's just like, it's hard for me to imagine a company like really doing the things that you guys do. So at least for me, I can't tell you guys how appreciative I am to have the relationship. And it's made me a way better coach for it. So. Thank you guys.
Love it. Love it.
Yeah, Chris, we appreciate it. It's been great chatting with you. From Mac O'Grady to science to poker and beyond, we appreciate all your insights. We'll have you on again. Thanks so much. This is the Ping Proving Grounds podcast.